Welcome, welcome, welcome back, everybody, to the Caught Red podcast.
We are back, baby. We are fucking back.
We're back.
Yeah. Classic. We are back. That's we right.
We are back.
And as always, I am still Megan Light, and he is still
Jesse Light.
And we are
still the Caught Red podcast.
And we are just two dog lovers here to talk some true crime, horror movies, and of course our dogs too. We took a couple weeks off. It was nice. We enjoyed a very quiet Christmas, an extremely quiet New Year's. I read, we put on Independence Day, the clock hit midnight, and
wrong
we were
holiday.
Like, it hit midnight, we're like, all right, it's bedtime.
Yeah, we haven't ever gone out since we've been together.
The last time I went out and did anything for New Year's was right before we met and started dating. So it's been like 6 or 7 years.
And do I really want to get out with a bunch of drunk drivers? And plus, we got our dogs at home and there were fireworks going off, but they...
I know, heaven forbid.
They weren't too shook up about those like they normally
are.
It
was so late. Like when July 4th happens, it's like right in the middle of the evening and they're more alert. They didn't really care.
Yeah, I think we still know what we're doing as far as, well, for the most part, as far as the podcast goes. I know it's been a while, but I think I still remember how to do it.
Besides all that we didn't do because we're not going outers, the only excitement we really had was Jesse had a bizarre medical mystery. I think it was just strange. He would have random swelling for a couple of days, and then that went away, and then hives appeared, and then they would disappear, and then they would come back, and they'd be in the most random places, and then they were just gone.
I've never had allergic reactions, so it was really weird. Didn't know what it was coming from.
We deep cleaned, we rewashed everything in different detergents. We
took a bunch of stuff out of my diet just to see. And I was like, well, let's try to bring some things back just to see if something happens.
Well, you were missing your cereal.
So. Yeah. Ate my cereal, all good. Ate my little protein bar things in the morning, all good.
Who knows what it was? You're just not a weirdo.
I have not brought back the energy drinks. I think I'm just going to go without them. Just drink more water.
You should drink water anyways. You can always try coffee.
Nah, I'm good. That's your thing.
It could be our thing. Mm, it's delicious. Jesse is going to tell us quite the adventure today. So much so that we were going to try and just keep the intro nice and short because it'll be a long one to kick off the new year.
Probably. First one. Yeah. Bear with me. I take you on a little ride, but it's fine.
Mine's going to be just as long.
We've actually got two prepared at once.
Let's not go crazy. That'll never fucking happen again. All right.
All that time we actually...
Just two.
We're
kind
of on top of things here.
Well, I had mine ready in case you felt like crap and couldn't really talk very well. And so I'm sure you guys will hear it a little bit in his voice. He's kind of nasally and he might hack. Or you'll hear him snot himself. But much better than you were a few days ago.
It do be that time of the year, so...
It is true.
And it's going to get even worse.
Oh, are you talking about when we get snow?
Yes. Ugh. I'm talking about the negative degrees that are about to come our way in a couple days.
You about to hear endless bitching from me.
Those toes are about to be so cold.
And my fingers.
All right. Well, without further ado.
Let's do it.
I've got one source for y'all today.
And I'm so proud of him.
It's a book.
It's a book.
I read it.
He did.
It is called Snake Eyes, and it was written by Biddy Martin. I like the name Biddy.
I do too.
And she spent 6 years working on this book. She interviewed more than 50 sources. So I thought that was pretty impressive. She knew the victim personally. They were childhood friends. And later on in life, she received a sign. And it gave her the idea, or kind of the purpose, really, to tell this girl's story. So this story takes place in Hot Springs, Arkansas.
At least we're starting off our new year of episodes with like a local one.
Yeah.
That's nice. Mine would not have been.
And I was thinking about that too. It's so crazy how many of these wild stories we have in Arkansas alone.
Never heard of half of them.
It's so wild. And I've mentioned Hot Springs before. We've done a case there called the Hot Springs Shootout. It was back on episode 15. If y'all haven't.
Back in the day.
Y'all can go check that one out. It's different. It was from like back in the day, like 1920s and shit. But it was not like any other southern town in Hot Springs. You had bathhouses. You had the Oaklawn Racetrack. You had the Southern Club. And all these mobsters from all over the U.S. came to the little old town in Arkansas.
Very random.
Because Vegas wasn't the thing. This place was the place. This was the happening spot. And Al Capone, Lucky Luciano, many others like that would come to Arkansas. And this was many years before the story I've got for you today, but there were still some pretty sketchy, scary men that ran around in Hot Springs during this time too. This story began on June 24th, 1966, when a 13-year-old Kathy Ward and a couple of her friends went on a summertime excursion to go horseback riding at Black Snake Ranch.
I love the name.
It does sound cool, huh?
That sounds real badass.
And this was just a few miles outside of Hot Springs. Later that day, the ranch owner, Frank Davis, would tell the police that Kathy Ward had been killed in a horse riding accident at his ranch after being dragged by a runaway horse. He said he tried to save her but couldn't catch up before it was too late. It ended up being ruled an accident at first, but many residents in the Hot Springs area believed Frank Davis had something to do with it. Biddy Martin, the author, talked about the reason she wrote the book. Biddy, her twin sister, and another friend named Leslie were riding in their parents' car down the neighborhood, and they spotted Kathy Ward walking down the street not far from her house. They yelled at her, trying to get her attention, but she never looked up. They were 100% sure it was her at the moment, but she looked like she was just on this mission to get home, walking fast with her head down, just determined to get home. But could it have been her? It couldn't have been, because they found out later that day that Kathy was at the Black Snake Ranch and had actually died.
So you think it was her spirit? Walking home where she wanted to be, where she would be safe.
Maybe. It could have just been another girl or...
Doppelganger. Yeah,
doppelganger. I don't know. But they couldn't believe it. I mean, they had just hung out with her a few days ago. And they were all going to see her that night at the dance at the YMCA building. And no one really talked about that day for a very long time. For the most part, it was very hush-hush. Parents definitely didn't discuss it with their kids. They'd kind of just changed the subject.
That's kind of strange.
I guess it was just a really sad day. No, I don't know. Somebody died.
I know, it's not a very young girl. Often,
yeah, you see like a 13-year-old girl dying.
I get that they don't want to talk about it because it's sad, but at the same time, I guess they were listening or thought more into like the rumors that you'll tell us about.
Yeah.
So they were like, well, we're not going to stir the pot, but still, like, that's, that girl's probably in your kid's class or like her parents are suffering. I don't know. It just seems kind of weird to not want to bring it up.
The main reason Biddy Martin wrote a book about Kathy was just sheer coincidence, really. Biddy had been reminiscing one day with Leslie, and they were talking about how Kathy loved to skateboard at Leslie's house, and the two were riding around together the week before Kathy's accident, and Kathy had to go home, and she accidentally left her skateboard behind, so Leslie called her up and told her that the skateboard was there, and that... And then they made plans for Kathy to come back over this next Saturday after her horseback riding day, and they'd ride skateboards all day again Saturday. But of course, that day never came. And when Leslie heard about Kathy's death, she went home to make sure that that skateboard was where she left it, and then she took it inside and put it in a safe place underneath her bed. She's had that skateboard ever since. And she rediscovered it on June 24th, 2014, which was exactly 48 years later to the day that Kathy died. So that was kind of a sign for them. Now, they had no idea where Kathy Ward was buried. It had been so long. So they decided to go to the local library, try to look up any information that they had on Kathy Ward. There was nothing there. They went to the sheriff's office, and they didn't have any files that went back past the 60s, so their next stop was the mortuary. But it had burned down, and the owner said all the files were lost.
How convenient.
Right, and he couldn't remember anything about Kathy. So they ended up going to the Garland County Historical Society, and luckily for them, they had funeral home records. So the volunteer at the front desk went back to look and came back with several sheets of paper. One sheet said that she was buried in Murfreesboro, Arkansas, which made sense because that's where her father lived. They didn't find her obituary, but at least, you know, they learned that information so they could go off that. So,
Good starting point. Yeah.
Biddy did as much digging as she possibly could. And she could still picture Kathy the last time she saw her, just as a young kid. She just wanted to make sure she wasn't the only one who could remember her for who she was. In the 1950s, Kathy's family lived in the small town of Murfreesboro, Arkansas. Her father was a doctor, and a doctor's family was like the closest thing to royalty in a small town of Arkansas like that. His name was Hiram, and then her mom's name was Sarah. And Hiram was dedicated to his profession, probably more so than he was to his family, which is kind of sad, but that's just the way things were sometimes. And Sarah was really hurt by this because she got him through medical school. And so she started drinking a lot just to kind of ease the pain. And because she wasn't really getting all the attention that she needed to. And in 1960, Sarah took Kathy and her two siblings, Dick and Lily, to Hot Springs. Sarah couldn't do life with Hiram anymore. And she suggested splitting the children's time up through a part-time living arrangement, but Hiram didn't want any of that, didn't want to put them through that either. He basically said, look, you take them or I'll take them, but they aren't going back and forth.
Good man.
Ultimately, he would end up coming to visit from time to time. During the summer, the girls would go stay with their father for a week at a time, and Dick would stay the entire summer. Then, during the school year, Hiram would visit the kids in Hot Springs once a week. It was about 60 miles from Hot Springs to Murfreesboro. He'd pick them up and take them to dinner at McClard's Barbecue and then return them back to their mother.
An hour's drive really isn't terrible, but I wouldn't want to do that every weekend or there and here. And yeah, I like that's probably a much better plan than all the back and forth that you see a lot of people do nowadays when they split time between households.
Yeah, hour's really not that bad. Like, it could be a lot worse.
Yes, it could be a lot worse.
And I'm not sure what attracted Sarah to Hot Springs. Like, she could have went anywhere, but it did kind of match her lifestyle because she was this single mother who liked to go out at night and drink and just leave their kids at home to take care of themselves. But
what a wild gal.
Divorce wasn't too common back then. Definitely not like it is today. And she probably felt like the Hot Springs area was more like accepting of her than any other town in Arkansas. Life wasn't easy for young Kathy Ward, though, with this whole move and the divorce. She was an introvert, and she missed Murfreesboro, mainly because her father was there. Luckily for her, though, she was this really nice and sweet young girl, so making friends was really easy for her, even though she was shy. And during the summer of 1966, she was actually dating this boy from another school. Kathy was a seventh grader. She was this pretty flutist.
A flutist?
Flutist. And she went to Central Junior High School. And then you got Mike Langley, who was this tall, handsome quarterback at Southwest Junior High. And they started dating. And then, of course, all the band boys who had crushes on her were jealous.
She's not dating a band geek. She broke their hearts.
Yeah. But that year, all Kathy really wanted to do was go horseback riding. And she asked her mother a million times, and every time she told her no. I'm not sure the reasoning behind why she said no. I know her friend Madeline was big into horseback riding and would always come back from the ranch telling her about all the fun that she had had, and it made Kathy jealous. And then one day, out of nowhere, that summer, her mother changed her mind and took her shopping for brand new red riding pants and brown leather boots. After all, it was her first time going, so her mom had to let her look like, you know, look the part.
That's cute.
And then, of course, she had on her new necklace that she got from her boyfriend, Mike. So on Friday, June 24th, 1966, Kathy and her friends Madeline and Peg would go to Black Snake Ranch, and it sat on 126 acres, Megan's dream. It was located on Black Snake Road near the Bull Bayou Creek, which flows south into Lake Hamilton. And Lake Hamilton is where all the rich folk go to water ski and
big
fish.
Big old houses.
Massive houses. And they all just go out there and party. It's like the frats and the sororities almost, but
Redneck Riviera on the lake.
Yeah. There was a long dirt driveway that led to this rustic-looking ranch house that was surrounded by beautiful pastures and ponds. There were barns and stables behind the house.
Sold.
You know, he should have just done a wedding venue.
Oh, that's the thing nowadays.
Yeah. Would have made a lot more money, probably.
Maybe they do there now.
Maybe. There was a shed out yonder where the starting point was for riders. Then there were riding paths along the backside of the ranch connecting to trails.
Our critters would love that.
Mowgli would run off. There'd have to be fencing for sure.
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
And he'd have to wear an orange vest.
Don't worry, he's got one
looking
now.
Like a deer out there.
I'm so, like, I don't want it to snow. I do, but I don't. But, I don't like the cold. But I'm very excited about all our puppies wearing their new sweaters.
They do love the snow. I hate the snow. Because nobody in Arkansas knows how to drive in the snow.
You are not lying.
There was also a cold spring that was dammed up that created a swimming pool below a cliff that everyone could jump off into and swim. So it did seem like a pretty fun place to visit. So I can understand the enthusiasm Kathy showed to want to go there. Now, the owner, Frank Davis, signed the papers for the ranch on June 1st, 1965. His whole goal for this place was to support his family, and he'd do this by selling cattle and training horses. Then he'd offer a day on the ranch, which included trail rides, swimming, fishing, barbecues, hay rides, and saddled horse rentals.
That would be really fun.
It does sound like a good time. Kathy Ward had a friend named Betty Jo Tucker. They were Girl Scout.
I love that name.
Betty Jo. They were Girl Scouts together. And when they got to junior high, their interest kind of changed a little bit. Kathy joined the band, and Betty Jo joined the pep squad. They stayed good friends, though, and that summer, all they wanted to do was go horseback riding. And Madeline invited them both, because she was the pro. She knew what she was doing. She'd been there a million times. Betty Jo asked her father if she could go horseback riding. And like most fathers, they're going to play the game of 21 questions. Or 20 questions. What is it?
20 questions.
Yeah, 20 questions. When, with who, where. And as soon as she told him where, he shot up out of his chair and said, no, no way. And he rarely said no to her, but this had nothing to do with anything that she did. He told her she'd never go to any place that involved Frank Davis.
Huh.
He said, do not ask me again. I know better. I know that man's character, and I don't want you to have anything to do with him. You're not going.
So I'm intrigued.
If it was anybody else's ranch, she could have gone horseback riding that day, I guess, but there's something about this Frank Davis guy that these other parents just like, no, he's a bad apple. Of course, Betty Jo was upset about this, but when her father told her later that night what happened to Kathy, she was just in complete shock. She had spent the whole day being jealous over the fact that her friends got to go riding without her. But now she's like, well, I'm glad I didn't go because it could have been me. She bent down to look in her nightstand drawer and grabbed the yearbook her friend signed before school had let out that summer. And Kathy had wrote a message inside for her. It read, this is to a sweet girl I've known for a long time. Good luck in the future. I'll always remember you. How could I forget? Then at the bottom of the message was, she wrote, 7th grade, 1965 to 66. And then that night, Betty Jo wrote underneath, died June 24th, 1966.
Well, that's real sad.
Yeah, that's sad.
That's really heartbreaking. It's such a beautiful little friendly message. And then she just makes it kind of, I mean, it's probably closure for her.
Mm-hmm.
But that's upsetting every time you want to look at your book.
And Kathy's death was in the Hot Springs newspaper the following day, front page. It was the final article on that page, and it read, girl killed in horseback riding accident.
And Betty couldn't find a copy of that? Remember, she went to the library and couldn't find anything about Kathy.
I guess it wasn't in the library. I'm not sure where she found it. Huh. She obviously found it because it's in the book.
Oh, you're right. Never mind. Ignore me.
No.
Sorry, go ahead.
Leaving that in there.
Nope. Fuck off.
Catherine Ann Ward, 13, was killed Friday in an accident at the Davis Ranch on Black Snake Road. The girl was apparently dragged to death by a horse she was riding when her foot caught in a stirrup. Frank Davis, owner of the ranch, which specializes in horse rentals, pursued the running horse but was unable to catch it before the girl was killed.
Can you imagine watching that happen?
That's terrifying, especially because it was in a field that had just a ton of rocks and crystals, so you know it was not pretty.
It was tearing her apart.
I hope not too many people saw it. Word spread around Hot Springs. Kids were all asking around to make sure it was true. They couldn't believe something like this would happen. All her friends were just counting their blessings that it wasn't them. Kathy's boyfriend, Mike, was actually supposed to meet her at the YMCA dance that night, but when he heard the news, of course, he couldn't go without her. When Hiram and Dick heard the news from Sarah, they packed their bags up and drove the 60 miles to Hot Springs right away to stay with Sarah. They couldn't believe it. Hiram arrived at the mortuary the next day, ready to see what kind of severe trauma killed his baby girl. Being a doctor, he wanted to know, but unfortunately, the mortuary refused. They insisted that her casket remain closed. Kathy had died tragically, and for some reason, the funeral service came less than 24 hours later. So she died Friday, and it was Saturday, which is crazy. That was usually it's a couple days at least.
Because there's planning and whatever you need to get done.
Like, they didn't even have flowers around her casket. So Saturday afternoon, 1:30, the service began at St. Luke's Episcopal Church. Kathy's closed casket sat there as family and friends said their final goodbye, and then she was taken to her gravesite in Murfreesboro so she could be buried with the rest of the Ward family.
I am glad they did a closed casket, even if she wasn't what I imagine being torn up, especially on her face. I remember when one of my best friends died our senior year of high school, and she had an open casket, and it looked like her, but it didn't. Like, it, you know, like if you go to like to a wax museum or something, and like how they look there.
I feel like
it kind of reminds me of that, and it's not that I didn't want to remember her. I have pictures, you know, from what she looked like before that, but when I think back to the funeral, I'm just like, I wish I didn't go down there.
Yeah, I never go up to the casket anyways. I've been lucky enough not to go to a lot of funerals.
Same. But, very same.
I feel like the younger they are, it's probably the harder it is to look in there and see them. That's just me. But
it was very different to see her embalmed like that versus like when I did my gross anatomy lab and we dissected a cadaver. It was obviously because he wasn't embalmed or anything, but it was just the difference thinking back how they looked and oof. Yeah, I don't.
No thanks. That's why I studied business.
Well, we would just happen to get a old fat guy as ours, so that was exciting. A lot to cut through.
A lot of the Hot Springs residents questioned whether it was an accident. Now, Frank Davis had a bad reputation around there, and a lot of people wondered if maybe his whole story that he told to the deputies was a cover-up. After all, he was a skilled rider, so surely he could have caught up to that horse and prevented Kathy's death if that was the true story.
Well, I don't know. Maybe prevented severe mangling of her. But if she'd fallen, that horse had gone, you know, she's maybe he could have saved her, but she would still been pretty messed up.
Right. Well, we'll get to what kind of person Frank was.
Oh, is he a bad boy?
And then you can kind of decide for yourself if you think it was an accident or not. Frank Davis was a 39-year-old ranch owner. His parents, Ray and Irene, had moved to Bismarck, Arkansas from the Texas Panhandle area. Ray was a barber and Irene owned a beauty salon. Ray saw promise in that area. He changed from a barber to a liquor store owner, then to a real estate agent, and then to a rancher.
What transitions are those?
Right. None of them were like related to each other. Well, I guess the real estate agent and the rancher, but still.
The liquor store owner. All right.
Irene continued her career as a beauty salon owner. And Frank was a head case from a very young age. No one could tell him what to do. His father tried to be the disciplinarian, but Frank would later say that all the spankings just made him meaner.
I was going to say before you said meaner, that's like you trying to tell our dogs to get off the couch or get off the bed. They don't listen.
Just talk back to me like, no. Or no, Mowgli will start wiggling his butt when I spank his butt. And he's like, yes, do it again, Dad. Do it again. He thinks I'm playing with him. Like, no.
It's so true.
Now, Irene, on the other hand, was kind of like Megan with the dog. She tried a different approach by giving him all the love she could hope, or she could, hoping to counteract her husband's approach.
That's why anytime you raise your voice or point your finger at them, they run to me. They're like, Mom.
Yeah. Megan's like, get down. Get down. No, no. Get down.
He ain't even lying.
Ripley's like, no means yes, okay. But all that love from Irene just made Frank think he could get away with anything. At the age of 7, he was jumping on horses and falling off of them too, each fall being a badge of courage. Frank had his own set of rules and felt like he was the roughest and toughest cowboy around. He thought he could whoop any of the other boys in town. He turned into an expert horseman. He was fearless. He'd ride his horse near cliffs and jump off into the water. He graduated high school in 1939 before he was even 15 years old. So he's a smart kid. His parents enrolled him in an agricultural school after that.
Very cool.
At 17, he graduated that and then joined the Air Force. He completed basic training and was selected for aviation cadet school. He became a flight officer in 1942, and then he was sent off to the South Pacific. There was an incident in the barracks where he was blindsided with a steel pipe.
Oof.
And after falling to the floor and passing out, he was carried to the infirmary where he remained unconscious for several days, so that probably didn't help. Later on, he crashed a plane that he was co-piloting. He somehow didn't get injured from that, but his superiors gave him hell and questioned him about it, almost like putting the entire blame on him.
Uh-huh, like it was intentional.
Yeah, and he was so angry by that that he blacked out for 3 days. And then he developed these bleeding ulcers, some so bad that he would go into shock and be sent to the hospital.
Oh my God.
And the Air Force ended up giving him an honorable discharge in 1945 when this problem just wouldn't go away. And then they would pay him a monthly check for $170. He had his degree in agricultural from Texas Tech. He taught adult conservation service classes and was a crop duster at one point in his life while working on his father's ranch.
We've all been a crop duster at one point in our life. Boom-sh.
He later became a U.S. cattle inspector. Then in 1953, he came down with undulant fever, which is a disease that is transmitted either through contaminated milk or by direct contact with infected animals. The meds the doctors gave him didn't seem to help. Only the babying from his mother and his first wife, Naomi, seemed to do the trick. And yes, I said first wife. At the time of Kathy's death, Frank was actually on to his fourth wife.
Dang.
Yeah, he got around. After a pretty long 14-year marriage with Naomi, he dumped her for Shirley in 1958. She was 12 years younger than him and was a member of his rodeo club.
They were definitely having an affair.
Oh, yeah, for sure. She was pretty tough and could handle herself around Frank. She was big and tall and grew up rough. And she didn't let Frank have his way with her like he did with most women. Shirley witnessed Frank destroy his favorite guitar into a million pieces across a coffee table. She told her sister-in-law that he had once put a gun to her head and threatened to shoot her. And she had asked Frank several times to see a psychiatrist, but he always told her no. She tried to leave him once, but told him that she was leaving him, and that didn't go well. He went out and slashed her tires. So, yeah, she wasn't going to leave.
Dang.
So the next time, she didn't give him a warning. Wife number three was Carrie. She was an attractive brunette and a graduate of Hot Springs High School in 1954, same as his second wife. So Frank was 12 years older than Carrie, too. And their marriage had been working, although Carrie would later say that she became scared to death of Frank. She told her employer that she knew enough about different things he did that she was afraid for her and her children.
Ooh, I'm intrigued again.
But what she knew, she never said. But he had a horrible reputation back then. Frank and Carrie became parents to a boy in May 1962. While she took care of the baby, Frank's chronic stomach pain continued to worsen from those ulcers.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd get so bad that he'd pass out on the floor, sleep, and then wake up feeling fine. But it had come to a point where he needed surgery and got a gastric resection. While he was recovering, though, he would stop in at his mother's beauty shop, and there was this new beautician in there named Sharon Knight. And even though he was still married to Carrie, Frank's mother would push him on to this new Sharon girl, even though, you know, he had a baby at home. Carrie was unaware of this affair going on. One day she told him that they were going to have another baby. And he pretty much said, well, that's tough. My girlfriend is pregnant too, and I'm going to divorce you and marry her.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? And he kept his word too, because on September 13th, 1963, the divorce was final. And Frank rushed over, picked up his new 19-year-old bride, Sharon, and they drove to Murfreesboro for a quick marriage. So yeah, 39 years old, marrying a 19-year-old. Notice the trend here. He liked him young. He was like the Arkansas Leonardo DiCaprio kind of.
Oh my gosh.
But this kind of brings me back to Kathy Ward. Kathy's father said she had her own mind. She wanted to do whatever she wanted to do. She was not defiant. It was not that kind of thing. You just weren't going to make her sit down and do anything. She was going to be into something. He said she was a party girl. She liked to go and do. She was not going to be controlled.
She took after her mama.
Sounds like it. She did whatever she wanted to, whether you liked it or not. But as long as she was here with him, they got along fine. Like, that wasn't the problem. The problem was that Kathy had a little secret that she kept from her parents. June 24th wasn't the first time she went horseback riding at Black Snake Ranch. She had actually been two other times. She would sneak off with two boys named Gary Sisney and John Dean. Gary was crazy about Kathy, and his buddy John, his mother pretty much was the type of mother that let her son do whatever they wanted, like drive them around wherever they wanted. So Gary got John to get his mother to take them to Black Snake Ranch and pick up Kathy on the way.
Oh, wow.
So obviously they didn't meet at her house. So she would, I don't know if she'd sneak out or what.
Go but say she'd go into a friend's house or whatever.
She had to have told her mother something, but she met them in a field like near her home, maybe like a few blocks down the street. And they'd go off to Black Snake Ranch. So she'd been on a horse before.
And she'd met Frank before.
Right. And that leads you to think about Frank Davis a little bit, who liked younger women.
13 is much younger than 19. It
is. Yes. So. He had seen this pretty little girl, though, twice prior to June 24th. Those two times she was with her little bodyguards, the two boys. He probably looked at her a certain way and thought she was cute. And
then she showed up on that day in those brand new red pants.
And she was with two girls instead of those two boys. And not to mention, one of her friends was quoted saying that Kathy was a lot more mature for her age than all the other girls. She said that she had the hourglass figure, whereas all the other girls were straight up, straight down. So if Frank Davis was a little perv, then, I mean, we could...
Yeah, connect those dots easily.
Yeah, you can use your imagination, like...
Well, Lord knows, maybe even from a distance, he may not even known she was 13 when he first looked at her.
Right. But, I mean, he could have took her off to teach her how to ride horses alone or something away from the rest of the group and tried something. She fought back and she like maybe fell off and hit her head or something, and he was trying to make it look like an accident, so he
strapped her foot in. Spanked the horse.
Who knows? I mean, that could have happened.
Very likely could have happened.
So although it was ruled an accident, Frank, I mean, he was feeling the pressure because, I mean, it was an ongoing investigation for, I think it was 17 days. Authorities had been on the property checking things out. So he might have been worried about what they might find. So, I mean, he was stressing out, paranoid.
Those ulcers coming back?
Yeah. I mean, he was still having issues from his stomach, so that didn't help. And then pair that with the fact that he didn't like his mother-in-law, Pauline, either. That was Sharon's mother. That's who he was married to the time that Kathy died. And they didn't see eye to eye at all. She didn't want her daughter to be with him because of the way he appeared to her as this like rough old cowboy. Probably didn't like the fact that he was closer to her age than her daughter's age, 20 too.
20 years older than his wife.
Lord. So there were tensions in the Davis home as well. And it wasn't just that. It was like when the toddler played loud with his toys, Sharon would rush over there to quiet him down. And Frank would yell at her to let the kid be a kid. But at the same time, when the baby would throw a fit, Frank would just come unglued and jump off the couch and pace around the house until Sharon stopped the crying. So
they didn't know what was going to set this guy off.
Yeah, he was a loose cannon for sure. On July 14th, the prosecuting attorney confirmed the investigation into the death of 13-year-old Catherine Ann Ward resulted from her being dragged by a horse in a riding accident. None of the facts established in the investigation, autopsy report, or in statements taken from law officers or members of the girl's family showed any evidence of the death having occurred in any manner other than having been dragged by a horse. Then the county coroner, Dr. William Mashburn, performed the autopsy and found that the cause of death was due to severe trauma to the head and brain. The findings were consistent with trauma that would be caused by Kathy being drugged by a horse with a foot hung in a stirrup. The rumors of rape and murder going around town were not mentioned. There was no word of a rape test being performed.
Hmm.
Kathy's father, Hiram, said, "The state police investigation ruled it an accident to start with, and I told them at the time, I don't believe this was an accident. But there wasn't anything you could really do about it." So at this point, the pressure was off Frank Davis after the ruling, but he was still dealing with paranoia. He would hear voices at night. He'd grab his gun and roam through the house, only to find that there was nothing there.
Uh-oh, this is not going well.
Finally, Irene called a family intervention for Frank, talked him into going to San Antonio, Texas to see a psychiatrist, you know, because he had refused it all this time.
Yeah, it's like you not wanting to go to a doctor.
It's not like that. I'm not hearing things and walking through the house with a gun or anything.
Not yet.
They pretty much made a whole vacation out of the deal, and Frank went to see the psychiatrist but came back to them and told them that the psychiatrist just said he needed to take care of his stomach. Back home, Frank was active in his rodeo club. He was a member of their guitar playing group. They were set to play at an election night rally on August 9th, 1966. Frank was a big supporter of Robert Ridgway, who was an attorney and the current municipal judge, and he was running to be a circuit judge. And so Frank and Sharon stopped beforehand to leave the boys at the home of Sharon's parents. I promise this is going somewhere, too.
No, go on. I'm here. I'm with you.
Frank played guitar with the band while Sharon sat with the other wives. Music would be played, then they'd stop and hear announcements of voting tallies. And then afterwards, Sharon was invited to another wife's home named Virginia for a post-rally party. And she was supposed to return by 10:30 p.m., but when Frank hadn't seen her, he calls up Virginia and asked for her, but she told him that Sharon wasn't there and her sister came to pick her up. So not sure what happened that night for her to just like leave Frank, but it was just a downward spiral from there on out.
Like she left him.
Left him.
Wow.
Yeah. He dials up his in-laws and Sharon came to the phone and basically told him like she wasn't coming back to him.
Holy shit. So
Frank was confused, didn't understand what had happened. When they left home that evening, nothing was wrong, I guess at least to him. And then, to add to his misery, his buddy Ridgway lost the circuit judge race. So two losses that night. Frank woke up the next day to a knock on his door. It was the same man he played guitar with the night before. But they weren't there for him. They were there to gather up all of Sharon's things.
Was she hooking up with one of them?
No, I think he had just pretty much been betrayed by his own buddies, and they were helping her move her stuff out.
Damn.
So now he's home alone, and he begins this new daily routine. So he would start every day by licking a lemon sprinkled with salt, and he'd down a half pint of whiskey. Then he would call up Sharon and ask to see his boys, and her response was always like, "I can't. I'm busy right now." Then he would demand for her to call him back, and like she never would, and so he'd just call her over and over and over again. So he just sat by the phone most days just waiting for her to call.
Just drunk as hell.
Yeah. Sometimes she'd tell him that she'd bring the boys over, so he would get all dressed up and cancel any plans that he had, only for her to never show up.
Oh, that's really sad.
Yeah, but he's kind of a douche, so Sharon left him literally like 46 days after Kathy Ward's death, so you got to think that kind of had to play into it somehow.
That she knew something?
Yeah, or she'd been hearing all the rumors going around. She might have known what really happened, though, and maybe she just didn't want any part of it. But I don't think he ever made that connection. He just wanted to see his boys, pretty much.
Right, and she wasn't letting him.
Yeah.
So dangling her kids.
Yeah.
Their kids in front of him.
So he was pretty much just drinking himself to death. smoking 3 to 4 packs of cigarettes a day.
Because that's great for his stomach.
Yeah.
And the rest of his insides.
And then just eating and sleeping poorly, too. And then he was neglecting his ranch, of course, forgetting to feed his livestock. And then he was still having the blackouts. So, man, this guy's just having a rough year. Then, to make matters worse, he was, again, he was paranoid, so he was thinking people were spiking his drink at night at the bars. He probably just didn't realize he'd been drinking all day, and that's why he passes out. I don't know. In September of 1966, Frank got into a car accident. He drove into the back of a woman's car. Yes, he had been drinking. Yes,
obviously.
They took his driver's license away. Of course, that didn't stop him from driving.
I was about to say.
Nobody's going to tell Frank Davis what to do. I mean, he was used to getting what he wanted. His mom spoiled him since he was a kid. So when his fourth wife wasn't budging, it was really pissing him off because he wasn't used to that. Frank ended up moving in with his mother in town. And the only time he'd go out to the ranch would be to feed the animals, but he's still like
neglecting them. Yeah. Those poor things.
So Frank would wake up, take his medication for anxiety, then he'd bite into his lemon covered with salt, chug his half pint of whiskey. He'd go down to the Bluebell Cafe on Central Avenue where he'd order soup. He'd take off to the bars for happy hour and then he'd stay till they closed. He'd get back to his mother's house and wouldn't be able to sleep, so he'd just continue to drink some more and pace around the house till finally he'd pass out. Irene would get up in the morning and clean up after him, and there'd be bottles thrown all over the house, all over the yard.
Mama, quit.
Well, remember when I said he liked to spend all his mother's money, right? So he had two trucks. And he decided, well, I don't need two trucks, so I'm going to take one of them down to the dealership to trade one in. So he went to the Ford dealership, and they were showing, like, all their 1967 models. And he walked around the showroom and stopped at a Blue Thunderbird.
Ooh.
He said, I'll take that one. But this is a guy who doesn't have a driver's license, right? So his mother pretty much had to sign off on it and put it in her name.
Mama, quit.
Well, that same week, he decided that he didn't like the Thunderbird. So he gives it to his mother and goes back to the dealership. He buys himself a red Ford GT coupe and a Ford Fairlane convertible. Yes, both of them. Never went to get these registered. It's like the Thunderbird was the one that actually got registered.
Thank God it was mom's car. I'd hate for my mom to get pulled over because I'm an idiot.
Yeah, but the cars were just like a diversion in his mind. You know, the main focus was always Sharon and the boys. He had bought both of the boys matching black ponies and saddles along with a wagon, and then he gave each a dog, a horse, and a cow. This was back when they were living with him, though. He wanted his boys to grow up right, but Sharon obviously put a stop to his plans, and that was like 36 days short of their 3-year wedding anniversary. A little over a month after she left Frank, Sharon was out shopping in downtown Hot Springs. She had herself a stalker. A vehicle slowly pulled up beside her, and she looked inside the driver's side window, and it was Frank. He says, I'm going to kill you.
Love.
What? You don't like my accent? What? I'm going to kill you. He yelled at her. She ran to her car and drove straight to her parents' house and told them what happened. And this wasn't the first time he'd stalked her. So she ends up getting a restraining order, but that didn't help any.
That's just like taking his driver's license away.
Yeah.
It's just like...
That's not stopping him. On January 15th, 1967, Frank genuinely believed Sharon and the boys were coming home to live with him. I don't know if it was just that? Yeah, I don't know if he was just being delusional or if it was something she said on the phone call that made him wishful thinking. Like, maybe she said, "Okay, yeah, we'll bring him by." But he canceled his plans that weekend to meet some friends and go deer hunting in Prescott, Arkansas. He waited the entire Sunday at the ranch and called her 3 or 4 times, but she never arrived. So he had to be fuming at this point, right?
Yeah, he's an asshole and a drunk, but that is really mean to, like I said,
not let him see his kids.
Yeah.
Well, here's where it's going to get crazy, all right? Just bear with me.
Because he's not crazy enough now.
Right, yeah. Frank's hunting rifle was still in his truck, but after Sharon flaked on him, he moved it to the back floorboard of the Thunderbird. And Irene had come to the ranch that day in the Thunderbird thinking Sharon was coming home, so she wanted to see the kids too.
Oh, that makes it even worse.
That they weren't getting to see their grandma either.
Right.
So on her drive back home, she had no clue the gun was back and that's where it stayed all week. And since Frank was back in town, he'd drive that car around town because it was the only one legally registered. Like it made a difference. He didn't have a license anyways, but neither here nor there. Obviously, Sharon ghosting him didn't sit well, and he let it marinate till Thursday.
Marinate.
He woke up mad, but kept to his usual routine, salt and lemon with a half pint of whiskey. Then he called up Sharon, which resulted in the same response as always, maybe. He took his anxiety meds and drove to the Bluebell Cafe, ordered soup, pulled out his liquor bottle. The owner looked the other way. After all, no one's going to cross Frank Davis, right? He finished that bottle, walked over to the liquor store for another bottle, then returned back to the cafe, called Sharon again and asked when she will be home. She said she didn't know and to call back at 5:30. Lord. So Frank calls up his friend, Terrell Adcock, and told him to meet him at his mother's house in an hour to help feed the cattle. And then he left the cafe around 3:30. Called Sharon again at 5:30, and she said, "I'm still busy. Call me back at the house at 8. Frank, talking to this Adcock kid, said to spy on Sharon for him. And before leaving Irene's house, Adcock called Frank and told him that Sharon was at her job at the Vanity Beauty Shop across from Arthur Cook's ice cream shop. It was Irene's 60th birthday that day. They were going to have people over that night. Frank wanted to go into town and pick her up a present at Kmart.
R.I.P. Kmart.
R.I.P. Kmart. After this call, Frank drove off in the Thunderbird and stopped at the Big J liquor store. And Adcock called the house again, but Irene let him know that Frank had went into town. So Adcock abandoned his little spot creeping on Sharon there at the beauty shop and went around town looking for Frank. And when he couldn't find him, returned back to his post, and there Frank was sitting in the Thunderbird staring at Sharon in the beauty shop.
My God.
Yeah. Pretty soon, Sharon's mother, Pauline, arrives in her 1962 two-door Chevy Impala and pulls up in front of the shop. And Sharon gets into the front driver's seat as Pauline scoots over to the passenger side. And Frank tells Adcock to go back to Irene's house and wait for him. He was going to follow that car. So Frank ends up following him. They stop at the laundromat, which is next to the Redbird service station on Central Avenue, which was like less than half a mile from Irene's home. The laundromat's front and back doors were full pane glass, so anyone could see straight through the building from the gas pumps in front to the laundromat parking in the back. Frank was sitting there getting gas where he could still creep on them.
Mm-hmm.
Then when he got done, he pulled around the building and drove up beside her car. Pauline was sitting in the front passenger seat holding the baby, and the little boy was in the back seat, and Sharon had taken the wet clothes inside to get them dried in the laundromat. When Pauline saw Frank, she got out of the car and screamed at Frank, "You no good son of a bitch. Leave Sharon and the boys alone." Frank was like, "I want to see my boys." Pauline replies, "I'm going to have you placed under a peace bond so you can't bother them and Sharon." Pauline got back into the car and picked up the baby. Frank slowly drives away, but he stops when he sees Sharon walking out of the laundromat's back door. He backed up next to the car again and shouted, "I want to see my boys."
Dude, you just saw them. They're in that car.
Yeah. Sharon ran to the Impala and jumped into the driver's seat. And she began arguing with Frank from her car to his car, basically. She cranked the window down halfway, and that's when Frank reached behind him and grabbed the hunting rifle that had been on the floorboard since Sunday. He sticks it out the window and fires a shot at Sharon. Pauline placed the baby in her seat and jumped out of the car, screaming for help. She runs toward the laundromat that was full of people. Now remember, it's all glass window. Yeah, everybody's watching this. Frank aims his rifle at Pauline as she's opening the door and shoots her as she enters the back door.
Damn.
And then Frank hightails it out of there.
Were the boys injured?
No, the boys were fine, luckily. But, I mean, he did all this in front of the boys.
Mm-hmm.
Pauline was laying on the ground by the door of the laundromat with a shotgun wound to the head. Luckily, it just grazed it, and she was laying there bleeding, but she was holding on for dear life. Sharon was lying in the front seat, her head and upper body slumped toward the passenger side door. And she ended up dying about an hour later in the hospital. And then someone came and picked up the kids, so they didn't have to see it anymore. I think it was somebody from the laundromat, just got them away from the scene. Police arrived, ambulance came by too. I mean, they got Pauline into critical condition at Baptist Hospital as fast as they could, I guess. But she wasn't conscious for a couple days. But it was obvious this time that Frank was the killer.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean,
he couldn't talk his way out of this one. There was no story he could tell. The proof was evident. There were too many witnesses that saw what happened. And people throughout Hot Springs didn't think that he would go that far. Like, he had always promised that he was going to kill her. He had made up his mind, though.
People say stuff like that all the time in, like, the heat of the moment.
Yeah. He said he was going to do it, and he did it, though.
She should have just let him see his kids.
Well.
Not saying that he wouldn't have hurt her at any other point, but
I mean, he probably was beating on her in the house. I'm sure she got away for a reason. So now people were urging the authorities to look at the Kathy Ward death ruling one more time, you know. But they still needed to put Frank away for Sharon's death. So Frank arrived at his mother's house not long after what he did at the laundromat, because it was only like a mile away. And to Irene, he was visibly shaken up. He walked through the back door of the house and into a back room, and his mother followed him in there. And when she walked in, she saw that he had a pistol cocked and aimed at his temple. So she rushes over there, grabs it out of his hands, and he tells her what he did, and then he just kind of slumps over halfway on the bed and passes out. And she can see that there was an empty bottle of pills laying beside him. Police Lieutenant James Holt and two patrolmen show up not long after Frank. They inform Irene of the shooting at the laundromat, which she's clearly already aware of. They ask to search the house and property. Lieutenant Grover Douglas and Detective Sergeant Bobby Digby show up too. And then prosecuting attorney Walter Wright was questioning witnesses at the crime scene. It didn't take long for Detective Douglas and Digby to find a .30-30 rifle with the barrel stuffed in a Levi's jacket out in the dog yard behind Irene's home. They brought that in with them as they walked back into the house to arrest Frank, and they found him passed out across the bed. So they call up an ambulance to take him to the hospital. Emergency doctors determined that he had taken some sleeping tablets. They ended up reviving him and then released him so he could be taken to the city jail. The next morning, Frank woke up in jail and had no idea what he had done the previous day. He freaks out, and the jailer said, "You killed your wife and you shot your mother-in-law." And of course, he doesn't believe it. He has no memory of it. At least he says he doesn't, and doesn't think he would do something like that.
I don't think he had memory of many of his days.
Because of all the drinking he did?
Uh-huh.
Probably. The jailer was like, "Well, you did. Then you took a bunch of sleeping pills, and they took you out on a stretcher to the hospital. So, yeah." When his attorney showed up, Frank knew it was serious because any other time he'd been to jail, someone just posted bail and he was free to go. Frank appeared for his preliminary hearing on January 24th, 1967, which was the same day Sharon was buried. He was represented by Jack Holt, who served 3 terms as Arkansas Attorney General in his mid-30s. Then he also had Robert Ridgway on his counsel, who was the same man Frank supported in the judge runoff from earlier in the story. So he had a pretty stacked counsel. After a few witnesses from the laundromat testified, Terrell Adcock was called to the stand. He said he'd known Frank about 3 months and had worked for him without pay to watch Sharon at her beauty shop. He worked for him out at the Black Snake Ranch too, but he had been watching Sharon for 4 to 5 weeks. He identified the .30-30 Winchester rifle the police had as looking like the one Frank owned. He said Frank had been drinking and told him to go to his house on Henderson Street because he had something to do. He was going to do something he should have done a long time ago. Jack Holt made a motion to try to reduce the charge to second-degree murder on the grounds that the state's evidence failed to establish necessary premeditation and deliberation. But Judge Mazander overruled and said the evidence was sufficient. And then he charged Frank Davis with first-degree murder in the shooting of Sharon Knight Davis, and he was taken off to the Garland County Jail. A week later, he was sent for psychiatric evaluation at the Arkansas State Hospital in Little Rock.
I'm curious what this will show.
Yeah. He was under the care of Dr. Shelton Fowler, and he built up a 19-page patient file on Frank.
God.
And just to kind of summarize it, because it was a lot.
Obviously, 19 pages.
He had 4 meetings with Dr. Fowler. And from what he gathered in those 4 meetings, at first he felt like Frank was extremely suspicious. He kept like changing the subject throughout the evaluation. He was trying to figure out, or he was trying to get a story from Frank, like what happened that day. But Frank just kept saying like, all he ever wanted to do was, you know, teach his boys to be cowboys. He just wanted to have lots of boys, but they took them away from him. He just kept talking about that instead of the actual story. He explained to the doctor that he had instances of paranoia. He said he'd seen people watching him and peeping around. He said he'd been followed for 5 or 6 years. Sometimes these people would follow him into town and flash lights in his eyes. Twice they put knockout drops in his drinks. They stole his money, his cattle, and his horses.
What?
Something going on in that head of his. He did admit that he had always been high-strung and would get angry easy, too. So Dr. Fowler's impression of Frank, he wrote it on a note and he said paranoid, probably schizophrenic. His understanding of why he was being evaluated seemed to be vague. He knew he was there for mental observation, but had no feeling that his examination was for any purpose than to determine if he needed treatment. He was unable to say that this had something to do with his responsibility for his crime. But Frank himself said that if a person did something, he did it, whether he was mentally ill or not, and whether he was out of his mind made no difference. He appeared to be aware of his situation, but said he had no desires one way or the other and didn't care what happened to him. So the four sessions resulted in two diagnoses by Dr. Fowler. One was manic depressive reaction, and the second was psychophysiological reaction of the gastrointestinal system manifested by history of peptic ulcer disease.
Wow.
So
it all went back to his tummy?
His tummy was causing some serious problems. Fast forward to April, that same year, 1967, there was a surprising twist. A grand jury indicted Frank Davis with the first-degree murder in the connection of Kathy Ward's death.
Ooh.
The grand jury met for 3 days, and their decision was based on information that alleged Davis attacked Kathy with a rock, causing her death, and then felt there was enough evidence to warrant a trial in the case. And this news appeared in the newspaper, and I can't imagine what people thought, especially like her friends and family, because it had been 39 weeks. Like, how? What did they come across a rock or something?
Maybe they got a better look at her skull.
Maybe. Like, what new information did they have other than the fact that they knew now that he was an actual killer? Like, he could have done something like this. But it turns out that Sharon had written in a letter what Frank had done, and she put that letter in a lockbox or like a safety deposit box. So she was like kind of coming back from the grave with revenge.
Oh my God.
But yeah, in that letter, she said he'd killed Kathy Ward and he had actually drowned another boy in the pond in the front of the house because that boy saw what happened to Kathy. And the authorities drained the pond and
there was a body.
There was a little boy in that pond. So the Ward family. Yeah. The Ward family had Sharon to thank for the new death ruling. No clue if like the actual murder weapon was found, if there was a murder weapon or if like, I doubt it. I doubt there was, like, a rock in the safety deposit box or something. That would have been wild, but
and why is this so heavy?
The gut feeling from, like, all the Hot Springs residents, though, was that Frank Davis did kill Kathy Ward. The question was just, like, if he could be if it could be proven, you know, innocent till proven guilty in the court of law, after all, so.
Well, no wonder she really wanted to get out of that house. He killed two people.
Right. On May 19th, 1967, Judge Hank Britt issued a court order stating the defendant, Frank Davis, has entered a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity, and the murder charge for Kathy Ward was now in limbo till this verdict for the death of Sharon was sorted out. Frank had spent the majority of his 189 days of incarceration in the Arkansas State Hospital. He lost Black Snake Ranch. It turned out he was like way behind on payments anyways. He escaped a third murder charge because Pauline survived. I believe she had just lost vision, but not sure if it was both eyes or just one eye. Now, I'm not going to go into a whole lot of details about the trial because we'll be here all day, but I did want to say, like, Jack Holt, who was the defense attorney, he explained to the jury that Oh, these guys piss me off so much, but he said, it's every man's right to a fair and impartial trial. He said, at the proper time, we are going to admit the killing. We are going to turn around and do what any decent, ordinary citizen, you or me or anybody else would do, that we say under the law, he's guilty of the killing, but he is not guilty of murder. There's a lot of difference between murder and killing. If that weren't true, everybody that was killed in the world wars, whoever did it, is guilty of murder.
This is not a war, sir. That was somebody's daughter, and that was somebody else's daughter.
It's a whole lot different than war, for sure.
Yeah, that's when you kill somebody half the time, it's a necessity. That's just a result of war. Kathy and Sharon, what did they do wrong?
Right. Then the prosecuting attorney just stuck to the facts, said, you know, it was a cold-blooded killing with two children present. It deserves the highest penalty possible. Because, I mean, shit, those bullets could have ricocheted, hit one of the kids.
That's why I asked if either of the boys got hurt.
Yeah, they got lucky.
That's a big risk he took trying to shoot her right there.
Yeah, because the baby was in the front seat. So, I mean, it could have went through Sharon and hit him easily.
Missed her and hit him
easily.
And her mom, yeah.
Especially from a rifle like that. So there was four doctors that testified, and it ended up being like a split, two for the defense, two for the prosecutors. Like two said he was not responsible for the murder, and then the two said otherwise. His ex-wife Shirley took the stand. She said she was married to him from 1958 to 1961. He was an insanely jealous person.
Was that wife number two?
Yeah. You had a Naomi, then you had Shirley, then you had Carrie, then you had Sharon, and then you had another. He was an insanely jealous person, which was a lot of our trouble. Started on our honeymoon, and he would make up things. My opinion, he's mentally ill. She said that she was afraid of him. She said she's seen him destroy things and cry like a baby at times. But when he was acting normal, you couldn't have asked for a better husband. She said they were divorced because she was afraid of him. He was so unreasonable. Irene got up on the stand and she was asked if he went into business for himself. She said he's never been in a real business for himself. Other than ranching and farming. He had cattle and horses and sheep. She said she's always managed things because she felt like she had to. She managed the finances because he was not stable enough to take care of it. His ideas were just too large for the amount of money that they had. By June 14th, 1968, the trial had seen 33 witnesses testify over 2.5 days. The jury deliberated for 2 hours. They found him guilty, and he was sentenced to death by electrocution at the state penitentiary on August 17, 1968.
Wow.
Now, the electric chair in Arkansas had actually been dismantled and stored at the prison after the 1964 execution of Charles Franklin Fields. I don't know who that is, but we'll have to check that out.
Hold on, let me Google.
Charles Franklin Fields? Sounds like a serial killer or something. But the chair could still be reassembled in short time, so it's fine. Old Sparky can make a comeback.
He was executed for rape.
Oh, well, there you go. Frank spent his following days in Tucker Prison. Megan knows about that place.
I do indeed.
15 men were there on death row at the time. Governor Winthrop Rockefeller was in office, and he was making his attempt at a prison reform. He was the one that ordered the dismantle of the electric chair in the first place. Frank sweated out his execution for only 44 days, unfortunately. So in a meeting with local leaders, Rockefeller announced that all inmates on death row in Arkansas would be granted a stay of execution until the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on the constitutionality of capital punishment. And then after that, Frank got even more good news because his first-degree murder charge for Kathy Ward was never going to be tried in court of law by judge and jury because there was a motion to dismiss. The case couldn't be proven that he killed her, pretty much. So that sucks.
Yeah, all they had was that letter.
Yeah, that's it. On December 29th, 1970, the inmates from death row were no longer facing execution. They were sent back into the general population of the prison, and Frank's death sentence was changed to a life sentence. Governor Rockefeller's term was up, and he was a lifelong opponent of capital punishment, so he chose to commute the sentences of all 15 men. You had 9 who were convicted of murder and then 6 for rape. And that was the first time in history that a governor commuted all death sentences at the same time. His reasoning was it was purely personal and philosophical. He said, "I yearn to see other chief executives throughout the nation follow suit so that as a people we may hasten the elimination of barbarism as a tool of American justice."
Sounds like a lot of bullshit to me.
Yeah, I agree.
You want to know a fun fact real quick?
I would have thought, honestly, that he was the first Republican governor in a long time, so I would have thought that he would have been for the capital punishment, but I guess not.
Well, remember when I did Ricky Ray, I think? The mentally ill guy?
Ricky Ray Rector?
Yeah. Clinton is a Democrat, and he was all for capital punishment and killing him.
Well, all right.
But do you want to know a fun fact real quick?
Yeah.
To intervene? So you're talking about how they haven't executed anybody in the state since 1964? So a man in 1976 was executed for the murder of a patrolman. And the man is John Edward Swindler. And it's funny that I came across this article because that's the latest book written by Anita Paddock, is that story.
Ooh.
So that'll have to come up later.
Anita.
On an episode. Proceed, love.
Proceeding. Now, Frank could have visitors since he was back in general population. Of course, he put Irene on the list, but he also put a woman named Wanda on the list. Okay, so this is wild. Of course, the whole story's been kind of wild, but this is...
Is this one of those Gypsy Rose and her husband things? They wrote letters to each other and...
Not exactly.
Okay.
Frank had actually been seeing Wanda since prior to killing Sharon.
Oh!
Wanda was there at Irene's 60th birthday party the night of Sharon's death. And it turns out that she was pregnant with Frank's child.
Shut up.
So all that time that he was trying to get Sharon back and trying to get the boys back, he was messing around with Wanda,
who
was pregnant with his kid too.
Maybe he has multiple personalities, and one of his personalities was hooking up with Wanda and got her knocked up, and then this other one was still hooked on Sharon. And
Maybe. His fifth child with Wanda would be born 6 months after Frank murdered Sharon. You do the math. Frank received a furlough to marry her in January 1975. They went to Searcy, Arkansas for that. A year later, Frank gets transferred to a minimum security facility in Boonville, Arkansas. It was the Department of Corrections Livestock Production Center, and it was a perk for his good behavior, but also because he had a degree in agriculture and his previous employment as a cattle inspector helped out too. Then there was a recommendation for his parole a month later, and it's just hard to believe because he hadn't even served 10 years at this point for murder.
Like cold-blooded,
yeah,
in everyone's faces.
Like his name. His name shouldn't even be in the same sentence as parole. You got to think he killed Sharon. He attempted to kill Pauline.
He more than likely
killed Kathy.
And a little boy.
And the little kid that drowned in the pond, yeah. We'll never know, I guess, but faced no repercussions for all of those. But God, there was so much backlash from the Hot Springs community when they heard about any possibility of parole. Because they didn't want him walking around free ever again, especially not in Arkansas, because he had promised to go after people, like, if he ever got out. And I'm sure he'd come after Pauline, for sure.
Finish her off.
The first request was denied, thankfully. But Frank and Irene never stopped fighting for his freedom. It seemed like she knew a lot of important people in Arkansas. And she was probably willing to give, like, all her money away to set him free. So, on the other hand, though, Sharon's family did everything they could to keep him in prison. Frank spent 9 months in Boonville when the prison board was in the process of moving him back to Cummins Maximum Security in October of 1976. The prison's regular, like, transfer van was on its way to get Frank when it broke down. And by the time it got to Boonville, Frank wasn't there.
What?
Frank had escaped.
Frank!
So, like, I literally just did a prison escape episode a while back, but here we got another one.
Surprise!
So he was missing from the bunk area around 1:30 a.m. October 15th. A horse and a saddle were also missing from the center's operations. And they alerted Arkansas State Police. Roadblocks were placed. Thankfully, he was captured only 3 days later. And he was only like 4.5 miles away from the prison. He was found in the woods and pretty much gave himself up and was unarmed. So that was kind of uneventful, but...
Oh, I expected a little bit more out of that.
Yeah, I thought he would have put up a fight
at
least.
What a letdown, Frank.
But there was reports that he had actually escaped multiple times. There were sightings of him in Hot Springs when he didn't have furloughs. And at least 3 people had seen him at the Garland County Fair. Apparently he was in charge of the cattle on the prison farm. And they gave him access to a horse to ride to tend these cattle. So he would ride the horse to the backside of the prison and tie up the horse. Then his wife, Wanda, would meet him back there and would bring him back to Hot Springs to the rodeo.
What?
Yeah, talk about, like, minimum security. He'd leave for, like, 18...
That's like no security.
No security. He'd leave for, like, 18 to 24 hours, come back and just tell them that he got lost. Frank was docked 5 years, 2 months, and 20 days of good time for his escape. But, I mean, like, did it really matter? He was still fighting to get paroled. He ended up getting diagnosed with ischemic chest pain, but was still being put to work. They had him on guard and duty, which apparently is every inmate's worst nightmare. He would keep a log of, like, all the hours that they made him work, just to kind of build up a case for himself. He was trying for some sort of medical exemption. And then on top of that, his mother was getting ill too on the outside, and he was trying to use that as an excuse as well, like saying he only had a few more visits left with her, stuff like that. He needed to be home to take care of her.
Shouldn't have tried to escape, bro.
Yeah, bro. I remember I said Irene knew people. Right? Important people. Irene and Jeff Dwyer were professionally associated until his death in 1974. He ran a salon in Hot Springs as well. He was married to Virginia Cassidy Blythe. Before she was married to him, she was married to a man named Roger Clinton Sr. They had a son, Bill Clinton, Damn. Who became governor from 1979 to 1981. And that's kind of when Irene started a petition. She got her bankers who wrote letters to the parole board and then wrote letters to the four governors who had been elected during Frank's incarceration. She gathered signatures from all her important friends. And the results were that Frank Davis became eligible for parole.
What a coincidence.
Right. The only like good news that came out of this for the Hot Springs residents and especially like Pauline's family and Sharon's family was that, yes, he did get paroled, but he was sent to Oregon and he wasn't allowed in Arkansas. So at least they wouldn't have to worry about him living there or coming back.
That's such a far distance.
It really is. And at first, Oregon didn't even want him. They denied that altogether, but like a month later, they either changed their minds or some money was slipped in some pockets or something. Yeah. In February of 1980, he was paroled to Oregon. His mother ends up passing away in December of 1980. And Frank died in 1984 from a heart attack, 10 days shy of his 60th birthday. So Irene spent the rest of her life and probably all her money trying to get freedom for her son. And then after she succeeded in that, she really only got 10 more months with him. And then Frank was able to spend his last 3 years with his daughter and his fifth wife, Wanda.
Oh, they went with him.
That's nice. They went up there with him. Pauline, she got the last laugh, though. She outlived Frank by 32 years.
Oh.
Go, Pauline.
One eye and all.
Yeah, she lived to the ripe old age of 89 and passed away in 2006. So just after doing all the research, I only hope that Kathy's death was an accident. Like, I hope that she didn't get sexually assaulted or anything awful like that. I hope it was just an accident. I don't think anybody will truly ever know, like, the details unless Sharon actually did. No, I'm not sure. It seemed like a lot of hearsay and rumors going around that time.
I would want to see if someone had a copy of that letter.
Oh, yeah. I would love to see exactly what it said.
If it existed? Did it exist? Or were they just saying it was in, like something was in the lockbox?
It sounded like it existed unless the whole letter was a rumor, too. And then it's just a shame what happened to Sharon. She didn't deserve that. I feel like there was enough red flags, though, for her to kind of just stay away from Frank in the first place. But it sounds like he was a ladies' man, so...
I didn't even know what he looked like.
I don't know what he looks like either. He was a rough old cowboy, I guess. I don't know. I'm glad Pauline survived and outlived Frank and was able to raise the two boys.
Good. Very good.
And I'm pretty sure they grew up to kind of like be ashamed of who their father was.
Would you?
Hell yeah. But yeah, it still just amazes me how many wild stories come from Arkansas like that. That's just crazy. And the fact that there were no other podcast episodes out there that I could find on this case, like that is a really good story.
I know. The whole time I think I had my hand of her mouth like, oh my God. Like,
shout out to Biddy Martin too for getting all that information, interviewing like 50, 60 people.
And so many had priority passed.
Yeah, yeah.
That's she the had a whole
list.
Part.
She had a whole list of all the people at the end of the book, how their lives turned out and such.
Hot Springs isn't really a small town, but if that happened there, I mean, think of all the tiny little nook and cranny places we have in our state and what goes on there that no one's ever known about.
Yeah, there's definitely some stories out there that need to be told that haven't been told like that. Crazy.
Did you like the book?
Yeah, it was a good book.
I'll have to read it. We bought it, right? On the Kindle, we have it.
It's on the Kindle. I wish it was a physical book.
I'll buy you the physical book and you can look at it forever.
It's like I said, it's easier to read a physical book than it is on the Kindle because I just get like stuck on one page for too long.
You zone out on it?
Yes. I need to touch the paper, I think.
Ooh, touch that paper.
Mm-hmm.
Good job, love.
Thank you.
Very good job. God, I just... Frank, what are you doing? Something snapped in him and he just... That breaks my heart for those boys, though. I hope they were young enough to not remember what happened to their mother.
Oh, yeah. One was a baby and the other was a toddler, so they...
Oh, good. Yeah. That wraps up another episode, our first one back for the year of 2024 here on the Caught Red Podcast. If you like us, share us, leave us a review wherever you listen to us. We want to get as many dog lovers to come follow us as we can. Well, and true crime, obviously. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram. Don't forget, you have to spell it P-A-W-D. For podcast. If you've got recommendations, we love branching out in this household. And we will be back next week with some more true crime. But until then, you better stay local, shop local,
murder local.